I'm really sorry about how everything's turned out, Finley. Truly. He's cracking his knuckles one at a time. I have to help Aaron now, okay? Stick with Wes in school. He'll get you through. It's about more than getting through, Russ says. Can we talk later tonight? I don't know. I have no idea what will happen at the hospital. I have to go. See you later, man. Russ nods once and then heads for school. He looks lonely walking all by himself, but there's nothing I can do about that now. Dad drives me to the hospital and we buy flowers at the gift shop near the cafeteria. I pick out a single yellow rose in a plastic vase, because I know Aaron likes yellow and the arrangement is the cheapest they have. I use Pop's $2 and Dad covers the rest. We walk to the part of the hospital where Aaron's recovering and tell the woman behind the desk that we're here to see my girlfriend. I don't have to lie about being Rod, because there are visiting hours in this part of the hospital. She looks at a chart briefly, runs down a list with the tip of her pen, and says, Aaron Quinn's not seeing visitors today. I'm her boyfriend, I say. Sorry, the woman says. Can you take this to her and let her know I'm here? I ask. She'll want to see me. She'll tell you so, I swear. The patient has requested that no one except her parents be permitted access to her. Those are her wishes. She's not a patient, I say, fully realizing how ridiculous it sounds, because Aaron is a patient. She's my girlfriend. Maybe so, but she doesn't want to see you today. Come back tomorrow. Maybe she'll have changed her mind by then. Can we send her a note through you? Dad asks. We can do that. The woman sighs as if we're asking her to do 100 push-ups or something equally insane. Do you have any paper? I ask. The woman stares at me for a second over her neon green reading glasses, and then she slaps a pad of paper on the counter. I hesitate, but then say, you wouldn't happen to have a pen, would you? She shakes her head with enough force to set her neck fat in motion, but she hands me a pen. I wonder why she's so angry, but then someone behind me says, this is asinine! Why can't I go in to see my daughter? I'm tired of waiting here! The woman behind the desk probably has to listen to people yell all day. I write, Aaron, Pop sends you this flower. He's looking forward to the next game of war. I skipped school and am in the waiting room. Tell them to let me in and we'll talk. Love, Finley. I fold the note in half and stick it between the stem and the white cotton-looking plant they stuck in with the rose. When the woman finishes speaking with the yelling man, she gestures to me and says, take a seat. When things slow down a little, I'll have one of the nurses deliver the flowers to your girlfriend. If she wants to see you, we'll let you know. How long will... Don't know, she says without looking up from her lists and charts. Come on, Finley, Dad says, and we sit down in the waiting room, where a half dozen people are watching Good Morning America. Some singer I don't know is performing outside in the streets of New York City. When she sings, you can see her breath. She doesn't look much older than me, and here she is on TV. How does that happen? Dad falls asleep while we wait, and I wonder if Aaron really doesn't want to see me. I start to worry. I feel confused. I can't imagine why I was denied access to her. Finally, Mrs. Quinn appears, looking very tired and unshowered, probably because she spent the night at the hospital, and says, I'm sorry, Finley, but Aaron doesn't want to see you today. Why not? She's tired from the surgery, and she's not looking very well either. You know how girls are about being seen without makeup. Mrs. Quinn is lying, trying to soften the news. Aaron never wears makeup. She doesn't even own makeup. It was nice of you to bring the rose. It really brightened the room. She hands me a note and then leaves. It's Aaron's handwriting. You shouldn't have left your game last night. You should be in school right now. Forget about me. Apologize to coach and enjoy the rest of your basketball season. Don't come back to the hospital. I can't see you. Aaron. I keep reading Aaron's note over and over again, but it doesn't make any sense. Just the other night, she practically begged me to be her boyfriend again, and now she says she can't see me? I start to feel sick to my stomach. I don't know what to do, so I just sit there waiting, hoping Mrs. Quinn will return with a smile on her face and say, just kidding! But Mrs. Quinn doesn't return. Good Morning America ends. Some talk show begins, and Dad snores through it all right next to me. He wakes up around lunchtime and says, how's Aaron? I show him the note. She's probably angry about what happened. She's not in shock anymore. She's feeling the full effect, but she'll come around. Do you mind if we stay here? I say. I'd like to stay, just in case she changes her mind.
I can sleep anywhere, Dad says, and then shuts his eyes.
After school ends, Mrs. Battle and the girls' team come with balloons and cards, but they aren't allowed in either, which really makes me worry about Erin. When I tell her Erin wouldn't see me, Mrs. Battle says, "Well then, we might as well get back to the gym for a late practice." Erin's teammates look sort of pissed off, which makes me angry because it's not like Erin invited them to a party, right? They leave all the get-well gear at the desk and file back out to the bus. Dad and I eat dinner at the cafeteria.
"You know," Dad says, chewing a bite of hamburger,
"Erin's family might be trying to protect you, Finley." "What do you mean?"
"Whoever hit her, well, maybe they're watching," Dad says, and then he glances around the cafeteria carefully.
"I don't care about any of that. I'm done with that stuff, Dad."
"You can't just be done with it," he says. "It doesn't work like that."
"Erin and I didn't ask to be a part of that world."
"Neither did I," Dad says, which makes me feel bad, because Dad's life has been pretty bleak, and through no fault of his own. "All's I'm saying is to give it time, and don't do anything stupid. You and Erin can leave Belmont someday. You could go far away like I should have done with your mother." This is the first time Dad has mentioned Mom in years.
"I thought we weren't supposed to talk about Mom."
"We're not." Dad finishes his hamburger, and the conversation ends. Because I don't know what else to say. There's a different nurse at the desk now, so I try one more time to see Erin. I'm denied access again, so I let Dad drive me home. Pop's drinking a beer and watching the Sixers game.
"How's Erin?"
"She refused to see us," Dad says.
"We sent a yellow rose into her with a note," I say. "I told her the flower was from you, Pop, and that you wanted to play her in war."
"It's a lot to take in a loss like that. She'll come around," Pop says. "Here's some strange news for you. Russ is up in your bedroom, Finley."
"What? Why?" I ask.
"Something about stars,"
Pop says, and turns his attention back to the TV. Dad and I exchange a confused glance before I jog up the steps and into my room. When I open my bedroom door, Russ is standing on my desk chair with his hand in the air like the Statue of Liberty. It takes a second to register, but then I realize he's in the process of turning my bedroom ceiling into a galaxy. He's already covered 2/3 of it with glow-in-the-dark stars.
"Surprise?"
Russ says half-heartedly when he sees me.
"What are you doing?"
"I wanted to do something nice for you," Russ says. "So, I bought you your own cosmos."
In spite of all that has happened, I smile. No one has ever purchased and arranged a galaxy for me before.
"Want to help me finish?" Russ says.
I nod, and then we're taking turns standing on my chair arranging constellations. It feels good just to have something to concentrate on, and when we've covered the entire ceiling, Russ shuts off the lights. We stretch out on the floor and bask in the weird green glow.
"So how's Erin?" Russ says.
"Not good," I say. "She wouldn't see me."
"Why?"
"Don't know."
"Give her a few days. Sometimes people need time and space."
For a few minutes, we just look at the weird constellations we made.
"Coach says you come to practice tomorrow, all will be forgiven," Russ says. "No questions asked. No punishment for missing today's practice or for leaving the game."
"Is that why you came tonight? To deliver Coach's message?"
"No," Russ says. "I came to put up the stars. Came to make you feel better."
"I don't know," I say. "I mean, thanks. I appreciate the kind words, but I feel like Erin needs me now. I wish there was something I could do for her."
"When I was in the group home, a woman used to read to us at night. I would just sit and listen. I couldn't even tell you the names of the books, but it helped. I never told that woman I liked it when she read to us, but I did."
"Maybe you could read Harry Potter to Erin. Maybe she'd like to escape to Hogwarts?"
"Maybe," I say. It feels nice to hang out with Russ, especially after all that's happened. It's almost like we can pretend we're still kids or something. And I wonder if that's also why we like reading kids' books like Harry Potter.
I don't know.
I'm glad Russ came to my house. I'm glad he made me a galaxy.
Chapter 34. Every day, Dad drives me to the hospital, and I walk up to the desk with the first Harry Potter book in my hand, ready to take my girlfriend to Hogwarts. And every day, the nurse says Aaron doesn't want to see me. So I sit in the waiting room, frustrated and angry. Mr. Gore says that if I keep going faithfully, eventually Aaron will let me in. When I ask how he knows, he says, "True love always wins." Which sounds corny, but I hope he's right. I don't go to basketball practice, which means that I officially quit the team. Coach doesn't come see me, nor does he send any messages through Russ, and I wonder if he's mad at me. Or maybe he's just happy to have Russ playing for him. Maybe in his eyes I already served my purpose. It's funny how one violent event can make you see the world so differently. When a mobster runs down your girlfriend with a car, basketball just doesn't seem so important anymore. And coaches talks about figuring out life on the court sound like so much bullshit now. Or maybe I did figure out life through basketball. People care about you if you can help them win, and they don't care about you if you can't. After a week or so, the nurse says Aaron has been moved to a different building for rehab. "What building? Where?" I ask. But they tell me it's confidential, which makes me mad enough to sprint back into the ward to see if they're lying to me. "Aaron!" I yell when I reach her old room, but there's an old lady sleeping in the bed where my girlfriend should be. A huge security guard grabs me by the arm and says, "I suggest you exit the premises quietly and without incident." He escorts me to the door, saying, "Don't come back." Because I have no cell phone, I walk across the street to the payphone outside the Wawa. But of course, someone has pulled the phone part off, so I have to wait outside the hospital in the freezing cold until Dad returns to pick me up. I start hanging out across the street from the Quinn's house. I just stand on the sidewalk all afternoon, waiting for Mr. and Mrs. Quinn to come home, so that I can ask them where Aaron is. But I don't see them for days. I even get up in the middle of the night and walk down the street just to see if their car is in the driveway. It isn't. A week or so later, a for sale sign pops up in front of their row home, and shortly after, large angry men start transporting the Quinn's furniture into a huge moving truck. "Where are you taking all this stuff?" I ask the men.
"Can't say," says a guy with a spiderweb tattoo on his cheek.
Another guy with a thick red scar across his neck says,
"You best move along. Now."
Pop and Dad say that Aaron is obviously being relocated. But by whom? And why? No one knows. I ask Mr. Gore if he's heard anything. He checks the computer system at school, which states that Aaron is being taught by home tutors. He doesn't know anything else. I go to the gym one day and confront Coach before practice is supposed to begin. "What do you know about Aaron?" I say, because he knows almost everyone in the neighborhood and he hears things. "Do you know where she is?"
"How would I know anything?"
Coach shakes his head and then says,
"I told you not to ask too many questions. Be careful, Finley. And I'm sorry things worked out the way they did, but you made your choice."
He turns his back on me, which lets me know he doesn't want any part of the Irish mob and won't be getting involved. He's done with me. After all I've done for Russ, I have to fight the urge to shove Coach. I feel so betrayed. Even though I realize there's not much Coach could do to help me, even if he were willing to take the risk. One night at 4 in the morning, when the neighborhood is asleep, I break into the Quinn's row home. There's no moon, I can't really see. They used to leave a key under the third brick in the garden, so I fumble around on my hands and knees, counting bricks and sifting dirt until I find that key. All the blinds are pulled, so once I'm inside, I can use a flashlight without being seen. But there's nothing left. Not even a piece of trash. Nothing. I shine the light on every inch of floor in every single room. I check every closet. I even look in the attic and basement. No trace of the Quinn's remains. It's like they vanished. I start to feel like I might puke again. I stand in Erin's room and it still smells like her. Peach shampoo. Her vanishing seems impossible. She would have contacted me if she were allowed, which means she probably couldn't contact me. I sit down on the pea-green carpet in the middle of 4 indented circles where the bedposts used to be. I hold my head in my hands. Where could Aaron be? How did I lose the best part of my life? I feel alone in the world. When I leave, I keep the key, although I'm not sure why. Maybe just to have some part of Aaron with me. I walk around in a daze for a few days, not answering anyone's questions about how I'm holding up. I can't think about anything but Aaron. I get so nervous about her whereabouts that I lose my head and barge into the Irish Pride pub one afternoon after school. I don't consider the consequences, I just stride in. It's a last resort, and the only place I can think of where I might find Rod Quinn. A half dozen men in black leather jackets are sitting at the bar drinking beer. I walk around the pool tables toward the men, and the bartender sees me first. He's got gray hair and a crooked nose, but he has kind blue eyes that seem to be telling me to turn around and leave before the men on the stools see me. "Excuse me," I say. Everyone turns around. No one smiles. "May I please speak to Rod Quinn? It's important." The men squint at one another in a way that lets me know I shouldn't have mentioned that name. The bartender says, "Hey kid, time to go." "I'm looking for Rod's sister Erin," I say. "She's my girlfriend."
"You shouldn't have come in here," one of the men says.
"Know your place, McManus. Don't be like your grandfather. Be like your dad."
I just want to know where Erin is. I'm sweating now, and my hands are shaking, but I don't care about what might happen to me. I need to find Erin. One of the thinner and clean-shaven men grabs the back of my neck, marches me over to the payphone on the wall, drops 2 quarters in the machine, and says, "Call your father and tell him where you are." "Where's Erin?" I say.
"This isn't a game, kid."
"Where is she?"
He squeezes the back of my neck so hard that my knees buckle.
"Call your father. I'm the nice one here. If those boys at the bar become interested in you, you'll be very sorry."
I punch in the number from my home, and Pop answers. "Pop, I need Dad to pick me up."
"Where are you?"
Pop says. When I hesitate, the man says,
"Tell the old legless man where you are."
I'm at the Irish Pride pub.
"What the hell have you done, Finley?"
Pop says. "Can Dad come pick me up?" The man takes the phone from me and says,
"Come pick the kid up, and don't let this happen again."
He hangs up and then pushes me outside where he lights up a cigarette. We stand on the sidewalk for a few minutes before I say,
"Where is she?"
"You really got a thing for Rod's sister, huh?"
"I love her. She's my best friend."
"That's cute," he says.
He flicks his butt into the street and lights up another cigarette. "If you want to see her again, I suggest you let things quiet down. Talk to your grandfather. He understands how these things work."
"Can I just talk to Rod?"
"Please."
"You really don't quit, do you?"
he says.
"You have no idea how lucky you are that I was sitting at that bar today."
My dad pulls up, gets out of the car, and says, "Lewis?"
"This one belonged to you, Patrick?"
Dad swallows once and nods.
"He busted into the joint and started making demands about his girlfriend, so I straightened him out before the others could. But had I not been around, this story doesn't end so happily."
"Thank you," Dad says, and then extends his hand. Lewis shakes and then pulls Dad in for a man hug. As he pats Dad's back once, Lewis whispers something into my father's ear.
"Get in the car, Finley,"
Dad tells me. As we pull away, he says,
"What were you thinking?"
"What did he whisper in your ear?"
"That I now owe him a favor. Do you know what that means?"
I nod. It means that my father will now have to do something for Lewis in the future. "Lewis is an old friend. We grew up together, so you got damn lucky today. But you have to stop. You can't keep asking questions. You have to be patient."
I don't want to understand any of what he's saying. I'm just a kid. I'm not part of the Irish mob or whatever they're calling themselves these days, or whatever they're forbidding people to call them.
When we get home, Pop's wheelchair is parked at the kitchen table. Grandmom's rosary beads are wound around his fist, but he's not drinking and looks sober. The old man is shaking his head at me.
"Are you crazy?" You can't know where Erin is right now," Pop roars. "Are you feckin' stupid, boy? Have you not been looking at these stumps of mine for a decade now? What's wrong with you? Those men you approached today would slit your throat for a dollar."
Pop's never cursed at me like this before. His voice is shaking. I've never seen him so angry. His accent's even coming out. "Feck." Dad puts his hand on Pop's shoulder, and Pop lets out a terrible sigh.
"Listen, Finley,"
Pop says, calmer now. "Sometimes a guy can get out of the organization by doing something big.
Something that earns him a retirement.
If Rod did something big,
he might have made some powerful enemies that would require him and his family to disappear. Could be that they didn't disappear fast enough, which maybe explains Aaron's accident. This is all speculation, Finley. Don't go repeating any of this. You have to be smart. I know Aaron. She'll contact you when it's safe. But your going around asking questions only makes things difficult for everyone. I look at my father and he nods. He thinks Pop's right. So, I should just wait for Aaron to contact me, I say. Do nothing? That's your best play, Pop says. And your safest, Dad says. Our safest.
How can I do nothing?
Chapter 35. One morning on our walk to school, Russ asks me to shoot around in my backyard, just the two of us. He says it could be our thing. I ask him why we need a thing, and he says,
"You seem different. Distant. Not yourself. Maybe shooting around once or twice a week would help."
He stops by later that night after his practice, and I tell him I don't really want to shoot around with him. "I'm done with basketball," I say.
"Just take 10 shots, and if you don't feel like taking an 11th, I'll drop it forever, okay?"
I sigh.
"Come on," Russ says. "Just 10 shots."
I follow him around the house, and we find my ball in the garage.
"I feel bad about taking your position," Russ says. "Especially after what happened to Aaron. Her accident, the way she disappeared. It really affected me. Sort of woke me up. I don't know why, but that night in the hospital, something clicked in my mind. And then it was like I started moving forward again, and you started moving backward. Now it feels like we're moving in opposite directions, and I miss having you around all the time. Everything got messed up for you, and yet things are going so well for me now, or better than I thought was possible at the start of the school year. Doesn't seem fair."
I don't know how to respond, so I don't. He's right, of course. I've been mulling over the unfairness of my situation for weeks. But hearing Russ state it so matter-of-factly hurts. Part of me is jealous. Part of me is simply defeated.
"The thing is, Coach was right," Russ says. "Playing basketball's been really good for me. I like the structure. I like playing. It takes my mind off what happened back in L.A. It's my future, too. I want to thank you for seeing me through my transitional phase."
Is that what he's calling his outer space act now? He's all but forgotten about being Boy 21. It's like basketball was his cure, his return to sanity.
"I think that playing ball could help you too," Russ says. "I realize you're done with Coach. I get that. But maybe you and I could..."
"It's just a game. Maybe it's your ticket to fortune and fame. And I'm happy for you. But I don't care about basketball anymore. I really don't."
"Just take 10 shots. I bet you'll want to take an 11th, Russ says, spinning the ball in his hands.
"Fine," I say, and then show a target. He hits me in the hands and I shoot. The ball goes in. Russ rebounds, passes to me, and I shoot again. We repeat the process, find a rhythm, and I start to feel my heart beating, my muscles loosening. I miss shots 5 and 7, so I end up 8 for 10.
"So?" Russ says.
I think about it. I understand why Russ needs to play ball. I understand that the game is going to provide him with many opportunities. I even understand why it's helping him mentally, keeping his mind off the bigger questions. But basketball isn't going to do the same for me. And shooting around is just a painful reminder that Aaron's no longer here. "Won't be taking an 11th shot," I say.
"I'm sorry," Russ says. "I don't want basketball to be a sore spot between us."
"It's not."
"So what now?"
"I'm gonna lie on the garage roof and stare up at the few stars I can see," I say.
"Can I join you?"
"Sure." We use the fence to help us climb up onto the garage, and then we look up at the 3 or so stars we can see through the light pollution and smog.
"You ever feel like you're not the person on the outside that you are on the inside?" Russ asks.
"All the time."
"Yeah. Me too," he says.
We lie there in silence.
"I'm sorry basketball's ruined for you," Russ says.
"I'm glad it's helping you," I say. "And I really am."
Chapter 36.
The days pass very slowly and super fast at the same time. Do you know what I mean? Maybe it's like a dream where time takes on a new sort of meaning. I don't know. Life gets blurry, distorted, stretched out, balled up. It's hard to explain. I go to school. I do my schoolwork. I talk to Pop, Dad, Russ, Mr. Gore. Things happen, but nothing really sticks in my memory. Nothing worth mentioning anyway. I just feel numb all the time. Empty. Sad. Sometimes angry. Mostly sad. Kinda pissed. Hollow. Tired. Cheated. Lonely. I think about Erin constantly. Where could she be? Is she somewhere better? Will she contact me? Has she already forgotten about me? What's going to happen? It's hard not knowing. It pretty much sucks. Belmont is like a prison to me. I'm here walking around, breathing, existing, but it feels like my life is somewhere else. Someplace better. Wherever Erin is. I think about Erin every second of every day. Erin. 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 Why hasn't she contacted me? Why? Chapter 37. Later in the basketball season, Russ and I are sitting on my roof again, trying to look at stars, which is all we do anymore. He usually visits me after every game, although we never talk about b-ball. Sometimes we don't talk at all, but just look up at outer space. I've overheard my classmates talking trash about how well the team's doing, but I don't need to know any more about it. Russ says, "Okay, now I'm really worried about you. It's freezer cold out, but I don't care. I enjoy the icy burn on my face and hands." Russ is wrapped up in my comforter. "The sky is overcast, so there are no stars." "Why?" I say, even though I know why. He's officially dropped the Boy 21 charade for good, and he's gone back to being Russ Allen, superstar basketball player. Since he's leading the conference in all categories, no one seems to mind that he was acting bonkers for most of the school year. Coach was right. Russ needed to play basketball more than I did. It's almost like I absorbed all of his craziness, like I was his leech, because he seems absolutely fine now. Well, I walk around school every day like I'm living on another planet. "You've been angry and depressed. You seem to be getting worse." "So, you're going to Duke?" I say, trying to change the subject. "There was an official press conference last week. News reporters came and videotaped Russ signing the agreement, accepting a scholarship. Everyone in the world knows he's going to Duke, so it was a stupid question to ask." Russ nods. "No word from Erin?" "Nope. Hasn't been that long. It's been more than 2 months." "Already?" "The worst part is that no one else seems to notice Erin's not around. Her basketball team didn't win many games without her, and there were whispers at first, but the school keeps on going, as does everything else in Belmont. It's like none of us really matter. Anyone could disappear and nothing would change too much. It's like our lives don't count." "I hate Belmont," I say. "I really hate it here."
"Then leave. The world's a big place, Finley," says Russ, sounding like Mr. Gore for a moment.
"There are many good places in the world. I should know.
I traveled around a lot before I came here.
How am I going to leave?"
"Someday, an opportunity will come. Think about Harry Potter. His life is terrible, but then a letter arrives, he gets on a train, and everything is different for him afterward. Better. Magical.
That's just a story."
"So are we. We're stories too," Russ says.
"What do you mean?"
"There are probably people who wouldn't think our lives are real either, if we wrote exactly what happened to us in a book."
"I'm sorry I haven't come to watch you play ball, but I just can't."
"No problem. Wes is a little pissed about your blowing off the book club, though."
I shrug. I feel bad about blowing off Wes, but he hasn't exactly been friendly since Erin's accident. Everyone in school knows that the Irish mob moved Erin, and because I'm the last remaining connection Erin has to Belmont, people are afraid to be around me. Wes has been distant. I don't blame him.
"I'd like to take you somewhere once basketball season is over," Russ says.
"Somewhere special."
"Where?"
It's a surprise. Does it have anything to do with Aaron?
No.
It has to do with the cosmos. I think you'll like it. I'm surprised he brought up outer space, because it's been a while since he's mentioned the cosmos. Do you think that Aaron will contact me?
Yeah, I do.
Eventually. Why hasn't she contacted me yet?
Don't know.
We don't get to know why a lot in life. My therapist told me that. Are you better now?
Russ looks up at the gray sky.
I mean, you don't call yourself Boy 21 anymore, I say. You don't talk about your parents flying around outer space in a rocket ship. You don't talk about leaving the planet. And you stopped wearing crazy costumes.
I wouldn't say I'm better.
I'd say I don't need to hide right now. Because things are going so well with basketball?
Because I'm moving on.
So it was all just a game. The outer space stuff, you just made it up to keep people from asking you questions about what happened?
Sort of like you pretending that you don't talk?
That's not the same thing. I didn't lie to people. It was hard for me to talk. Too hard.
Maybe so. And it was hard for me to be an Earthling, too.
You've been talking a lot more lately. More than you did when I met you, anyway.
Does that mean you're better?
I think about what he's implying, and maybe he's right. Maybe we were both playing roles just to get by. So what happened to your parents? I ask.
What happened to your mom?
I'm not ready to talk about that, and it seems like Russ isn't either. Because we sit on my roof silently for a long time before his grandfather pulls up in front of my home, and Russ says, "To be continued." I remain on the roof for a few more hours, and then I lie in bed, looking up at the weird green glow of the galaxy Russ gave me. Chapter 38. The team loses the state championship game by 1 point. I hear Terrell miss the last shot. Russ and everyone else mourns the loss for a few weeks. Students walking around the hallways with their heads down, teachers frowning, the entire school seeming depressed. But then, life goes on, and Russ remembers that he wants to show me something. About a month or so after the big loss on a Saturday, Russ and Mr. Allen pick me up.
You ready for your surprise?
Russ asks.
Sure.
I climb into the back of the Cadillac and watch Belmont's ugliness slide across the window past my reflection. Russ reads directions off a piece of paper, and his grandfather makes the necessary turns. After an hour or so of highway driving, we're on a road with many trees, passing horses and cows even. I see corn stalks, fields of plants I can't identify, long stretches where there are no houses or streetlights or anything man-made at all. I've never been to a place like this before, and it makes me sit up and swivel my head right and left so I don't miss anything. The wind coming in through the window is warm and full of scents that seem so alive it almost hurts to breathe it all in.
Manure, Mr. Allen says, as we drive through an awful smell.
What's that? I say.
Cow shit, Russ says.
Fertilizer, Mr. Allen says.
Helps the crops grow.
Even the manure smell is okay with me, because it's unlike anything I've experienced before. Different than the smell of Belmont's sewer system. To be clear, I don't like the manure smell, but I like being in the countryside. We take a bumpy dirt road through the woods, and I get a little nervous, because if we break down out here, there's nothing around for miles. But then I spot what looks like a gas station. A sign outside reads, Star Watchers Paradise. There's actually an exclamation point, which makes this place seem extra exciting. We pull up to the gas pump. Mr. Allen fills the tank, and I follow Russ inside, where there's a worn wooden floor and a few aisles of food and camping supplies. A large red-faced man sits behind the counter.
Howdy,
he says, and shows us his pink palm.
We have a reservation, Russ says. It's under Allen.
Sure thing! You picked a beautiful night.
No clouds at all. Your eyes are in for a feast.
We've been checking the weather all week, Russ says.
How's viewing station number 12 sound?
Fine, Russ says.
Mr. Allen enters the store and stands next to us. The man writes something down on a piece of paper and then hands us each a brochure.
These are our viewing rules. Unless it's an emergency, do not turn your car on until first light. You must pull the blackout shades in your station if you have a light on inside. absolutely no flashlights or lights of any kind may be used outside of your station. Once the sun goes down, library voices are mandatory, which means you need to whisper. You'll be asked to leave if you hoot and holler. Other than that, just enjoy the show. I'll need you each to sign the rules brochure to verify that you agree to the terms. Mr. Allen gives the man a credit card. We all sign the papers, receive complimentary star charts, and then get back into the car. What is this place? I say. What's the show? You'll see, Russ answers. We drive down the dirt road and pass numbered wooden signs marking unpaved driveways that bend and disappear into the woods. When we find number 12, Mr. Allen makes a left, and we drive on a dirt road so narrow, branches whack the car.
I'd better not see any scratches on my Cadillac, or someone named Russ is going to be waxing and buffing all day tomorrow, says Mr. Allen.
The road curves off to the right, and then we come upon a strange-looking structure that sort of looks like a cross between a treehouse and a lighthouse. It's an eight-sided tower that rises up and out of the woods. A huge bucket sits on top. The building reminds me of that piece in chess that looks like a castle.
Well, I'll be,
Mr. Allen says, but he's smiling. Come on, Russ says. We enter through a door on the ground and then climb a spiral staircase to the center of a room with four beds and two windows that have heavy curtains. The blackout shades, I assume. There's a small bathroom, too. Just a sink and a toilet. No shower. Russ keeps climbing and I follow until we have to push up what looks like a trap door in the ceiling. It opens to the sky and we climb onto a viewing deck that has a tall wooden railing so that it seems like we're standing in a gigantic wooden cup. The floor is covered with what feels like a wrestling mat. My feet sink an inch or so into it.
This is where we'll sleep tonight, Russ says. The beds inside are for the old man.
I look around and see nothing but new green leaves of early spring trees and the tops of the dozen or so other viewing towers, which are spaced maybe 100 yards apart and form a circle. This is amazing, I say.
What have I been telling you? Russ says.
There's more to the world than Belmont, right? We race down the steps and carry the cooler and other supplies up into the sleeping room. It takes Mr. Allen a long time to climb the steps, but when he reaches the top, he looks around and says,
I've never seen so many trees.
Who knew that you could drive 2 hours and be somewhere like this, I say. Russ smiles proudly. We eat the tuna fish sandwiches Mrs. Allen packed for us and drink root beer as the sunset shoots fire across the treetops.
I don't want to be climbing steps in the dark, so I'm going to settle in downstairs with my book. You two have fun, and don't get too close to the edge, you hear?
Mr. Allen says, and then he disappears into the hatch. It's getting cooler up here. There's a stiff breeze and the trees are making a lot of noise. Do you hear the leaves hissing? I say.
Cool, huh? Almost time for library voices, Russ says, making air quotes. I bet sound really carries up here.
We both lie down on our backs and my shoulder blades sink into the mat.
This place is truly awesome, I say. Thanks for bringing me.
He nods, and then we watch the western sky glow in orange pink. We lie there in silence for 15 minutes or so, and then, out of nowhere, Russ says,
Tell me what happened to your mother, and I'll tell you what happened to my parents.
Why?
Because that's what friends do. They talk to each other and listen.
It doesn't matter.
It does.
I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Don't you trust me?
Russ asks. I do.
Well then, just me and trees around.
Is that why you brought me out here?
It's part of the reason. And I'd prefer to talk before the show begins.
The stars?
Yeah.
We look at stars on my roof all the time.
This is different, you'll see, he says. Let's talk about what happened to our parents. I really think it might help.
I talk to my therapist all the time. You should probably be talking to a therapist, too. I've been talking to Mr. Gore.
That's good.
Talk to me. It's a depressing story.
So's mine.
I don't know. We'll use library voices, so it won't really count anyway.
I smile. Library voices.
I want to know Russ's story, and I don't really care anymore about keeping Pop's secrets, especially since Aaron's gone missing. Maybe that's why the bad stuff happens in neighborhoods like mine,
because no one talks. But even so, I'm surprised when I hear myself using the library voice, when I hear myself telling the story for the first time. I tell Russ about how my grandfather stole money from the thugs he worked for so he could take my grandmother back to Ireland. She had terminal cancer and wanted to die in her homeland. They were born in County Cork. We still have family there, but they were always too poor to make the trip back. I've never been to Ireland, but returning before she died was very important to my grandmother. So, out of desperation and grief, Pop stole the money and took her, thinking they'd be safe once they were out of America. The only problem? The rest of his family was still in Belmont. My Pop underestimated the ruthlessness of his co-workers. The thugs Pop worked for took me to get to my grandfather, to get him to come back from Ireland.
What do you mean they took you?
Russ says, using his library voice. I allow myself to remember. Remembering makes me feel like someone's jabbing a finger into my throat. I begin to feel sweaty. My grandfather was mixed up with bad men. Men like Aaron's brother, Rod. Probably hard for you to imagine.
So they kidnapped you?
I swallow. I haven't talked about this with anyone. Not even Aaron.
It's good to talk. You can trust me.
I search the sky above for early stars, see none, and then tell him what I remember. I remember men in ski masks taking me in the middle of the night, my parents screaming, and the sound of my father being beaten. I remember being thrown into a car trunk, my hands tied behind my back, an awful sock in my mouth, tape around my head. I remember being in a dark room for a long time, peeing in my pants because I was so scared, smelling only dried urine and dust for what seemed like weeks, being hungry and thirsty, and then suddenly I was with my father again, only it was at my mother's funeral, and my Pop no longer had legs. I remember my father's eyes were so red, like raw hamburger red, and his face was still bruised purple and yellow. I remember Dad telling me that my mother went to the police and tried to rescue me, but that was why she was dead. And then he told me that I could never tell anyone about what happened. Ever. I was never allowed to tell a single person, or else we all might end up dead. He told me not to snitch, so I didn't. I was just a little kid, and I was so afraid of saying the wrong thing, losing my dad and Pop too.
So that's when you stopped talking?
Russ says. Yeah. It's also when I started playing basketball.
Damn.
I can't remember what my mother looks like, I say. We have photos, but I can't see her anymore outside of the picture frames. Do you know what I mean?
Sometimes I feel like I'm forgetting the sound of my father's voice, Russ says.
What my mother smelled like.
So many things.
What happened to them? It's like the western trees are lined with pink neon now. This is the last of today's light. Russ takes a deep breath and then says,
carjacking.
Mom and Dad went to see a friend play saxophone at a bar in a shady neighborhood. Some crackhead shot both my parents in the head and then ran off with a few $100, my mom's jewelry, and my dad's watch. Completely random act of violence. Completely unfair. Stupid. Enough to make you want to check out for a while and tell people you're from outer space. What do you see? I ask, not really sure why I'm asking. When you try to remember your parents together, what's your best memory? He thinks for a few minutes. This one time I went to see my father play with a throwback old-time style big band, and halfway through the set, the leader asked my mom to join him on stage to sing a song. I was surprised because I didn't even know my mom could sing. She didn't want to get up, but the audience started to clap for her. So she took the stage and said, you boys know my song. My father switched to trumpet because he could play any instrument. He played the opening notes, and then my mother sang Ella Fitzgerald's I'm Beginning to See the Light. My father stood next to her, and they sort of communicated with music. Mom was singing, Dad was playing trumpet, but their eyes were locked the whole time, and I could tell they were so in love. The crowd clapped for 5 minutes straight when they finished, which embarrassed my mom. I could tell because she kept shaking her head and wouldn't make eye contact with anyone.
You sing? I remember asking her when she sat down next to me.
And she said, I used to, a long time ago.
As we watched the rest of the show, I remember wondering how many other things I didn't know about my parents. You only get to know so much.
When it's clear that Russ is done talking, I say, that's a beautiful memory.
Do you have one like that of your parents together?
I think hard for a minute. No, not like that one. Russ doesn't say anything in response, so I worry that he feels bad about sharing his good memory when I don't have one to match his. I don't want him to feel bad, so I say, but someday I might tell someone about stargazing with the NBA's best point guard, Russ Allen, back before he was famous.
Let's not talk about basketball, okay?
Russ doesn't say anything else, which makes me think that it was really hard for him to talk about his parents. The sky goes from navy to black. And then all of a sudden, millions of stars blink above us, and Russ whispers, I think the show has begun. It's almost like someone flicked a switch, because there were only a few stars here and there, and now there's an endless supply, like a huge diamond exploded in the sky. It's so beautiful, I say, because I've never seen anything like it before.
Whenever I think the world is ugly, that life has no meaning at all, I remind myself that this is here, always waiting for me. Russ says, I can always look up at the cosmos and marvel, no matter what happens. And when I look up at it, I feel as though my problems are small. I don't know why, but it always makes me feel better.
And that's enough, I ask, just looking at stars?
It can be, Russ says.
I expect Russ to begin naming all the constellations, but he doesn't. We lie silently under outer space, taking in all those pinpricks of light, and I too feel dwarfed by the massive universe. I wonder if Aaron is also looking up at stars tonight, maybe sitting on some roof somewhere, thinking about me. I wonder if my mom's up there in heaven or simply up there somewhere, maybe even on some after-death spaceship or something like Boy 21 had imagined. Why do you think we met? I ask. Do you think I was supposed to help you return to basketball? Was it fate?
It's because my parents were murdered by crackheads, he says. I'd be in L.A. if my parents were still alive. Other than that, I don't know.
But you're here somehow,
I whisper.
And so are you,
Russ whispers back.
We lie next to each other in silence all night, looking up at the impossible, mind-blowing awesomeness of the universe. And I don't think either of us sleeps a minute.
Chapter 39. On the anniversary of my mother's murder, just like every other year, Dad, Pop, and I lay flowers on her grave. Kathy McManus. June sun, blue skies. No one else is in the graveyard. Standing there, gazing at the endless rows of headstones, it feels like we're the only three people left in the world. As far as my eyes can see, white and gray grave markers line the earth, each with a tiny bit of information. Name, years lived, maybe a nice quote, but not enough to really let you know who these people were. I wonder if each marker has a story just as complicated as my mom's. Like every other year, I remember the kidnapping. Think about the courage it took for my mother to go to the police, and wish I'd gotten the chance to know her better. In his wheelchair in front of the grave, Pop talks to my mom and says he's sorry over and over again, cries a lot, and is a guilty mess. When you get your chance to leave Belmont, Dad says to me, take it. His face is tense. Wrinkles shoot out from the corners of his eyes. He's staring at Pop in this really weird way. It's like he loves and hates the old man simultaneously.
You hear me? Dad asks.
Yeah.
When I was little, I used to think that we visited my mom's grave because she was somehow there. Like we were really going to spend time with her ghost or something like that. Now I realize we go so Pop can repent. I wonder about my mom. This might sound dumb, but the only thing I really remember was that she loved green lifesavers, which she called the Irish lifesavers. She used to buy a roll almost every day and feed me as many as it took to get to the first green one, which she'd eat. This was our little ritual. We'd walk to the corner store in search of her daily green Irish lifesaver. It's a stupid thing to remember, but it's what I have. And the truth is, I've always gotten very nervous whenever I see someone eating lifesavers, or if I see a roll in the store. I worry that if I look too closely, I'll discover that green lifesavers don't exist. I'm terrified of maybe realizing that I made up the only detail about my mom I own, and then I'll have absolutely nothing left. Maybe that's a dumb thing to worry about, but it's just who I am, what life has given me. Dad never talks about mom anymore, ever. And Dad never eats lifesavers either. At least, I've never seen him eat one. When we leave the cemetery, Dad spends the rest of the day with Pop. I spend it alone on the roof, hoping that Erin will crawl through my bedroom window and snuggle up to me, like she did so many times before. But Erin doesn't show up. Chapter 40. The morning before my high school graduation ceremony, while we're eating our eggs and bacon in the kitchen, Pop hands me a plain white envelope. "What's this?"
"Open it," Dad says. I tear it open and pull out the contents. There's some sort of ticket that reads Amtrak.
"Amtrak?" I ask.
"It's a train. You do know what trains are, right?" Pop asks.
"Why are you giving me a train ticket?"
"Graduation present," Dad says.
"To where?"
"Read the ticket," Pop says.
"New Hampshire? Why did you buy me a ticket to New Hampshire?"
"We didn't buy it," Pop says.
"Read the letter," Dad says.
I unfold the paper and immediately recognize Aaron's handwriting. My heart nearly explodes and I start to sweat.
"Erin!"
I stand and walk into the living room.
"Where are you going?"
Pop says, and I can hear laughter in his voice.
"Finley, you don't know how much I've missed you. You can't imagine how much I wanted to contact you in the past 6 months. It's been torture. I hope you don't think I didn't want to see you back at the hospital. I didn't have a choice. I wasn't calling the shots, which I'm sure you figured out by now. I can't say much in this letter. I'm not allowed. I'm somewhere very unlike Belmont. It's beautiful. People are nice to each other. You can walk the streets alone at night. Everything is so clean. You could eat off the sidewalk. So many stars, trees everywhere. I have my own tiny apartment, if you can believe that. And I'm already enrolled at a small liberal arts college and set to begin this fall, although I won't be playing basketball. Things have been taken care of. That's all I can say in this letter. Oh, and I'm going by Katie Reedy now. Do you like the name? Can you get used to it? Do you want to come live with me? I'm serious. Seems like your family still has some friends left because it's been taken care of, as they say. You can't tell anyone where you're going, and you'll have to change your name. I'm thinking we'll call you Lucas Williams. How about that? Do you like it? It has a nice ring, doesn't it? I have enough money for us to live a decent life. You could apply to the college and who knows? Or you can get a job. I'll explain everything if you come. I hope you will come. I love you. Please get on the train. Just come. Trust me. Please. Love, the girlfriend formerly known as Erin. I run back into the kitchen and say, "What is this? Is this for real?"
"It's a chance to get out of here and start fresh," Dad says. "Free and clear of your family history. It's a chance at life."
"Where did this note come from?" I ask.
"Don't ask questions," Pop says. "This is the real deal. A true chance. No strings attached."
"How do we know it's not a trap?"
"A trap? You've been watching too many movies," Pop says. "If they wanted to hurt you, they'd come to the house and hurt you. They wouldn't buy you a train ticket and hurt you in New Hampshire."
"What did you have to do to make this happen?" I ask.
"Nothing," Dad says, "except promise silence."
"I'm not stupid," I say.
Dad and Pop look at each other. "Let's just say," Pop says, "some of the older guys still feel bad about what happened to you when you were a kid, but they respected the fact that we kept our mouths shut when the cops came asking questions all those years ago. There are rules, but we're not all monsters. Most guys do what they can, when they can."
"The train leaves in 2 hours, so you have to make your decision now," Dad says. "If you go, you can't come back to Belmont. Ever. And you'll have to be careful about contacting us. They'll explain the rules to you, and you'll have no choice but to obey every one."
"Why?"
"Those are the terms. We don't get to ask why." I remember what Russ said about not being able to know why.
I sit at the table opposite Pop and Dad and notice that their physical similarities are striking. I wonder if they're thinking I look like a younger version of them. Three generations of McManuses. So I'm going away on mob money? I say quietly.
You're going away, Pop says. You're not going to be taken care of for life. You're just getting a ticket out of here and a chance to start over someplace better.
I think about it and wonder about ethics.
Do I really want to accept mob money? Even if it's only a little to help me relocate. Could I live with myself? After all they've done to my family, am I owed this?
And if I don't go, I say. Dad shrugs. Then you go to community college and live in Belmont for another 2 years minimum. And maybe you lose your best friend forever. This is most likely a one-shot chance here.
Will Rod be up there? Mr. and Mrs. Quinn?
Don't know, Pop says. I absolutely want to see Aaron, but I don't know about the rest. How can I choose between the two men who raised me, the only family I have, and the girl who's been at my side since elementary school? It's easy to choose between Belmont and anywhere else, because I don't want to end up alone, rotting away in a row home, drinking myself to death. I definitely want out of this town, but I don't want to leave Pop and Dad behind. What do you think I should do?
They look at their hands. Their eyes are welling up. They've already decided what I should do, which is why they gave me the envelope. But the final choice is mine alone. The doorbell rings.
That's Russ, I say.
Don't tell him anything, Dad says.
I cross the living room, pinching myself to make sure I'm not dreaming. When I open the door, Russ peers through the screen and says,
"What's up?"
"I'm not going to school today," I say. "Not going to walk in graduation."
"Why not? You sick?"
I don't want to lie to Russ, especially since I know this might be the last time I ever speak with him.
"What's going on, man?" he says. "You all right?"
I think about what I can say to make him understand. And when I have it, I smile. "I just got a ticket to Hogwarts."
"What?"
"Might be taking a train ride to a magical place that's much better than here. Don't tell any muggles, okay? But I want you to know I'll be all right." Russ squints through the screen for a moment before he returns my smile and says,
"She finally contacted you."
I can neither confirm nor deny that statement.
"I have no idea what's going on, but I feel like I should hug you."
"We can do that." I step outside the house. Russ and I hug. A real hug. Forearms. Big squeeze to say all the things we can't or maybe won't.
"I'm not going to ever see you again, am I?" Russ says.
"Don't know."
"Be good to yourself, Finley. I wish you a beautiful life."
"I wish you a beautiful life, too. Many clear, starry nights. And a few collegiate basketball records," I say. Russ looks into my eyes the way he did when he first came to Belmont, like he's communicating with me, then smiles sadly and walks away. I watch him stride down the street, and he throws a few sky punches, which I take as a sign of approval, like he's happy for me. So I return to the kitchen.
"You going to get on the train?" Dad says.
"I'm scared to leave my family. It's hard for me to think of being anywhere but Belmont." Then I remember the night I spent with Russ in the country. There are other places in the world, better places. And I say, "I'd really like to see Aaron." Pop nods once and then looks out the window. I'm surprised when he closes his eyes, fingers Grandmom's rosary beads, and starts to mouth words. I've never seen Pop pray before. Dad and I go upstairs and pack up my belongings, which aren't much. I stuff clothes and jackets and shoes into a duffel bag, peel a few stars off the ceiling, and slip those in too. I grab my framed picture of Mom and Dad and me from back in the day, and then I find my basketball in the garage, because maybe Aaron will want to shoot around. Pop and Dad drive me to 30th Street Station in Philadelphia, and on the way there, they explain that a man will meet me in New Hampshire, and that I'm to ask no questions, none whatsoever. He will drive me to Aaron, but he won't say anything to me at all. I'll know who he is because he'll call me Lucas. "This seems crazy," I say. "I'm a little freaked out."
"You'll be fine," Dad says.
"You've already been through the worst part of your life," Pop says. "Go be with Aaron. She's a good woman who loves you. The key to your happiness.
Trust me."
"I know, because your grandmother was an even better woman. I would do anything to be with her now. Anything."
We park outside of a huge white building. Cars, taxis, and people are everywhere.
Finley?
Pop says just before I get out of the car. I turn around and I'm surprised to see the old man trembling.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, Pop.